Thank you. Good morning. Last day. I have to thank Ken for representing us here and organizing wonderfully this meeting. My talk is based on some recent work with Farhad Jafari and not so recent work with John McCarthy. Farhad is a student of Rudin and of Forelli, and he carries their obsessions and frustrations and unsolved problems. And I want to talk about one of them, which is notorious in several circles, in several complex variables, in Banach space theory. It's a computation of characterization, classification, computation of extremal points of positive pluriharmonic functions. We didn't do too much progress on this, but at least I claim I understood a little better what Forelli and others did, and I want to share with you some easy aspects of the theory. In short, what you will see today is more algebraic than analytic, although we deal with limits and measures, and I could characterize it as algebra of Cayley transforms. So you will see a lot of Cayley transforms at work, and it's fun. The plan of the talk is the following. I'll recall Riss-Herlov's theorem, then the basic facts about positive pluriharmonic functions, measures, which are limits of this on the ball. I'll work today only on the unit ball of CN. An attempt to characterize, and a failure to characterize, the extremal elements via disintegration technique. Then I'll turn into some more positive aspects related to analytic duality, and finally relations to operator theory. We have to mention somewhere multivariable operator theory, and it is here indeed. So bear with me, it will be on the end, but it will be spectacular, I can assure you. Now, we may ask ourselves why we go into several variables, why we try such classifications. I wanted to find a good quotation, and the best is George Bernard Shaw, who says that crude classifications and false generalizations are the curse of organized life. He was not a mathematician, but I think he understood very well that sometimes we can go to the extreme with classifications and with our generalizations. And this is a bad example. What I'm going to tell you is, I think, a dead end, a classification which you should not try to do. So let's start. The basic tool for us is, and this has appeared several times in during this week, is the Riss-Herlov's theorem, which relates functions with positive real part in the disk with positive measures on the torus. And the representation is well known. And what it is remarkable here is that this is a dictionary between this class of functions and all positive measures on the torus. It goes back and forth, as you know. I'll explain a little the proof for the students we have here. And I think this is the fundamental brick, the fundamental tool for us, because it relates analyticity with measure theory and with, when we speak about the realization, with operator theory. You can immediately obtain von Neumann's inequality from here, and you have the characteristic function involved here, and so on. So it's really the quintessential result for us. And any attempt to extend it in several variables leads to ramifications. There is not a single way to do it. And I'll speak about an analog on the ball. So how do we prove this? Just for my students. And I think I have one student here, and now I'll invite Roger to the blackboard to do the proof. You should know it day and night. So what are we doing? Suppose that the function is defined slightly on a larger set than the disk, which we can do it by homotety, and just playing with Cauchy's formula, we remark that if we put the real value of the function against the variation of the argument, we obtain this representation. Now the measures which appear on the right are positive. The mass is the same, so is the value of the function at zero. Therefore we deal with a weakly star compact set of measures, and the limit exists. Of course you may ask, what happens if we have several limits? That's a little difficulty can be resolved, and the full weak star limit exists, and this is the measure we are talking about. Now, what about the extremal functions? This is, of course, a convex set. We can multiply them with positive numbers. We can add them. In the whole representation, if you are looking at the right-hand side, this when we take the limit is any measure. What are the extremal elements for all positive measures, say, of mass 1? We normalize everything. We cut this convex cone with a slice to make it bounded. And obviously, all probability measures have as extremal points point masses. And surprise, the extremal elements are rational functions of degree 1. So let's try to go to n variables. We'll work in the ball. S is the sphere. And again, let's consider analytic functions in the sense of several variables with a positive real part normalized to be 1 at 0. Again, we can take boundary limits, and we find some limit measures, exactly as before. We repeat the procedure. And we end up with a representation which involves, rather than the Segre kernel on the torus, the Segre kernel on the sphere, which is exactly this one. Now, for completeness, I want to go slightly into the proof, simple details, because there is a little trick here, which I would like, again, our students to know it from now on. Suppose we are in a space with a reproducing kernel, and we work with such functions with positive real part. Fix a point W. Let me see if we find a point there. Well, we can do without. So we have the reproducing kernel on the sphere, the Segre kernel. I denote simply with a star the complex conjugation, and without any inner product the Hermitian structure. And we apply twice the reproducing formula to the function f times the kernel. Let me put this on the other slide. This is quite convenient now. we add, and look what we get. On the left-hand side is a polarized real part of the function times the kernel. On the right-hand side, we have a positive definite kernel. You see it's again a polarization, and the measure which appears there is the surface measure on the sphere times the real part of the function. So positive measure, the total mass is 1. We can pass to the weak star limit, and we obtain a nice representation for the polarized real part. If we take particular values, we obtain exactly what I mentioned before. And this representation is important because the kernel which appears on the right-hand side is invariant under biholomorphisms of the ball. So this is the right kernel to do potential theory in the ball. There are three different kernels. This is the good one because when we rotate with automorphisms, everything remains invariant. So that's the formula. And now the basic question is, we have these limit measures. What can we say about them? There are computations of this kind in the 60s, appearing in the work of Koran and Pukansky, although they did it for the polydisk. And the Russians, Eisenberg, Dautov, have a series of articles about classical domains, all Cartan domains, where they derive such formulas. So the unpleasant fact here is that not every positive measure appears as a limit of such real parts of analytic functions. And the question is, can we characterize them? So what can we say? A first attempt, if you want a naive approach, is to look at the moments. And we remark that a sequence of an infinite sequence of moment conditions characterizes these measures, and they appear because in the formula, if you remember, on the left hand side we had a separated sum, analytic plus anti-analytic. So when the monomials are not comparable, the measure is orthogonal to them. And then, of course, we have the conditions that the support is on the sphere, which is represented in the other conditions. So this goes if and only if, but is useless, unfortunately. As a definition, and this is standard in several complex variables, such a measure on the sphere is called a P measure, and it's characterized by the fact that its invariant Poisson transform written there, so that's exactly the kernel we have computed before, is pluriharmonic. That means it's harmonic along any complex line, or equivalently is the real part of a complex analytic function. And in this case, the formula, as we expect in a Poisson representation, reproduces the measure by taking weak limits from inside. So all is well, except that we don't know too much about these measures. You may ask, we deal here with harmonic functions. What happens if we work with the usual Poisson kernel on the ball? Forget about the complex structure. This works as well, but it's not invariant under biholomorphism. This is the formula, if you remember. And this is tricky to use because we cannot keep track of the pluriharmonicity. I'll not enter into these details. Anyway, let's denote by Pm plus this class of positive measures. And I'll stick to probability measures, which corresponds to a slice in this code. Now, basic observations, which may look very surprising at the first encounter. Suppose that we have such a measure, and we take a Borel set on the sphere of Hausdorff measure 2n minus 2, 0. That means it's rather thin. The sphere has dimension 2n minus 1. Then if I generate the big circles passing through this set, so I take this thin set, I generate all the big circles, the measure will be 0. So this is highly non-concentrated. Every P measure is highly non-concentrated. Cannot be, for instance, an atomic measure. And even more interesting, suppose that we take the complex directions, which means the projective space of the right dimension, and we take the projections from the sphere onto the projective space, so to each point we associate the complex direction, and we have, this is a compact manifold, we have the invariant measure there. Surprise, surprise, the normalized P measure, any, on the pullback of a set from the projective space, that means which sees the full circle, is invariant. So always charges with a measure of the invariant kind of hard measure on the projective space. Why it is so? Let's think a little. These measures are limits of real parts of analytic functions. What happens if we integrate an analytic function on a big circle? We have the mean value theorem. It will give us the value in the center. And this explains essentially what is going on. There is more. Alexandrov has a beautiful survey, and I'll give you the references exactly at the end of this talk. He proved that if we cut on the sphere a Euclidean ball, then such a measure is very smooth with respect to the radius in the sense of these two inequalities. Now, these are not too hard to prove. You have to look at the kernel and just estimate, standard estimates of the invariant Poisson kernel will lead to such representations. So, in particular, big discovery, every point of the sphere is in the support of such a measure. And I want to give you a different proof of this. I'll use the chalk. I didn't know how to do all the fancy drawings on the computer. So here is the idea. We have the sphere. Let's suppose that we have such a measure mu. And let's denote by mu sharp the Poisson transform of this measure. So this is a function inside the ball, which is pluriharmonic and has as distributional limits exactly the measure itself. Suppose that a point, let's say zeta, is not in the support of the measure. So that means that a full neighborhood is not charged by mass by this measure. So let's cut such a neighborhood. From the representation using the Poisson kernel, we see immediately that this function, which is pluriharmonic inside, will be continuous up to the boundary because we don't have mass there. On this portion. So it's harmonic here and continuous up to the bound. Easy to see. Take a close enough point to this boundary point, and through it, take a line. Which is perpendicular to the vector going to the fixed point. If we are close enough to this, the full complex line will be inside this spherical cap. So what we get? Mu sharp along this line is harmonic, continuous on the closed disk, so this is just a one-dimensional disk, and is zero on the boundary. Therefore, mu sharp is zero at the point x. And x was arbitrary in a neighborhood of theta. We are done, because we deal with harmonic functions. So that's the idea, and keep it in mind that these measures are diffuse, and they are very smooth. Now, all this is fine, and there is much more theory of these measures. This led Aleksandrov to a beautiful proof of conjecture of Rudin, namely that there exist inner functions in the unit ball, a deep study of these measures. So, let's sum up a little. We have equivalent objects. The analytic functions is positive real part, normalized to be one at zero. They can be written using Cayley transform as quotients of functions from the ball into the disk, and the normalization is now zero goes to zero, that's quite clear. Positive pluriharmonic functions in the ball, again with a normalization, and these P measures, probability P measures, which give the representation. So far, so good. Now, extremal P measures. This is a convex cone. We take a slice. We have a nice convex set. What are the extremal elements? The only necessary condition known so far is due to Forelli, saying that if such an element is extremal, then the contractive function in the representation, so from the ball to the disk, is irreducible. That means cannot be factored into a product of two contractive analytic functions. And the proof is extremely simple and is beautiful, and I like to share with you some of the details. So here it is. Let's assume by contradiction that this function is factorable. And we choose one of the factors to vanish at zero. And of course, you can put a constant against this one of modulus 1. We rotate, the value of the other one is on the imaginary axis. In the end, we'll write f as a sum of two functions in the same class. So we'll contradict the extremality. And we do it as follows. So maybe let me save this slide there. Simple but useful algebra with a Cayley transform. The first identity is easily verifiable, just multiply with a common denominator. And remark that if we take the inverse of such a fraction, the real part remains positive. And the second identity, again, is immediate. Therefore, we have f as a convex combination of these two new functions, f1, f2. You see them there. Easy to verify. Assume that f is extreme. Therefore, they coincide. And just working a little at, you see on the right-hand side, at the identity between these two functions, we obtain a relation between age, one of the factor, and g, the other. Age is a transform, is a, again a Cayley transform of a Möbius transform, if you want, of the second factor. Simple manipulations, that's the message here. We don't have to remain with the details, but it's extremely elementary. We'll show that we have the representation of F into two terms. And this will imply immediately, if we do the computations, that H at the center of the disk is 1, therefore is constant. So very, very simple. Okay, so we have one necessary condition. The function in the Cayley transform has to be irreducible. Immediately, we go back to our well-known example, and this shows that in the one-dimensional case, obviously, which are the only contractive irreducible functions? From the disk to the disk, sending 0 to 0, they are rotations. And this proves again that the extremal elements in the one-dimensional situation are rational of degree 1. One step further. Now we like to understand the structure of this extremal element. And it's very useful to do a disintegration of these measures. You remember they were limits of the real part, along slices, along complex directions. So we fix a point in the ball, not necessarily on the boundary, and we take the complex line through it. Obviously, the restriction of the function there will be in our class, so by the one-dimensional representation, we have such a measure which relates to the function. Of course, this is a probability measure with our normalizations, and we have a nice relation between the Segur transform of the full measure and all these slices. Now, question: how these measures along each slice relate to each other. And there is a simple characterization. It's worth mentioning that Alexandrov used a different disintegration, namely he takes just the complex direction, so not a point in the ball, and he has this integration on the projective space. And his construction of the inner functions in the ball is essentially a one-dimensional, but keeping track of all these changes with the measure. What we are doing here is slightly different. Let's denote S the Segur transform of measure on the torus. And let's remark that this family of measures labeled by zeta in the closed ball is C infinity inside, obviously, it's a real part of a function, is continuous up to the boundary. That's just the Dirichlet, the continuity of the Dirichlet problem on the one-dimensional situation, and it satisfies a very natural automorphic condition. So you can bounce a scalar of modulus less than 1 from the index of the measure into the argument. That's an automorphism. So in short, these are C infinity families of measures with some automorphic condition. Now we'll put them at work. If we look at the moments, we can expand everything in series, and this is quite convenient. We can relate the moments of the slice measures with the moments of the with the Taylor coefficients of the function, rather. Let's not go into the p measures. So that's quite convenient and easy to obtain, just series expansion. And this is the most important example. Here I wanted to arrive. This function is extremal, and I'd like to take the time to show you in full detail why it is so. Because if we understand this, we can produce a lot of examples of extremal functions. So, it's a rational function, degree 2, and we have to look at these slice measures. We take a point of coordinates AB on we are in C2 on the sphere, and remark that if we are inside, this measure is simply the real part of the function times the variation of the argument. And this gives immediately, if we factor the rational functions into linear terms, degree 1 terms, gives a hint why we cannot separate this into two functions, simply because these slice measures will charge every harmonic function with two point masses, but at quantities which do not depend to infinity on the parameters. So this break of smoothness is the reason why we don't have a decomposition. So let's do it in full detail. In particular, if we take A and B real, that means we intersect the sphere with the real part, we are on the real circle, and in this case, the measure, just immediate computation, is the sum of Dirac masses. So any convex combination of this, suppose that the measure is a convex combination, would imply that one of the terms, when we take the slice exactly at that point, has to be one Dirac mass. You cannot split a sum of two Dirac masses in anything else than two Dirac masses. So this implies, let's make a choice that, and this continues with the parameter. So we have the choice to move this continuously. This will imply that one of the terms in the convex decomposition is exactly a Dirac mass for all AB real and on the sphere. We do the computations, and this will imply an identity between between the moments. So on the left-hand side, you recognize this is the rational function with a point mass at 1. On the right-hand side, we should have an analytic function in the whole ball. We identify, and we get linear relation between A and B, but on the other hand, they were subject only to a quadratic constraint. So A and B are on the circle, and on the other hand, they should satisfy this identity. Impossible. So this shows why this function is extremal. Now all is well, and this idea can be pushed a little further. I'll go faster over these details. So you may ask, how far can we generalize this disintegration of measures? And it goes quite far. Forelli did something similar, although his proof is not with slice decompositions. And here are the details. Again, F is a polynomial, homogeneous, but of different degrees of homogeneity if we split the variables into some subsets. And we assume that this polynomial, like the one we had before, achieves its maximum on a thick subset of the sphere. And once we have this, everything works fine, exactly as before. So the main idea is we take such a slice, suppose that alpha is the value of the polynomial at a point on the sphere. Manipulations with KV transforms, we have this decomposition of the rational function into factors, into linear terms, simple fraction decomposition, and we carry this through the function. It's on the last line here. And then if we have splitting, a convex splitting of the function into two terms, this would imply that we have to make a choice in this equally distributed, you see these are the vertices of a regular D-gon on the circle, and it's quite simple to see that they cannot be related to any smooth function inside. They will not vary smoothly when we are on the full sphere. So that's the idea. I'll skip these technicalities and switch to something more positive. Of course, we deal with positive measures, functions, but I claim that this is at least better understood. So we fail to understand these extremal points. For instance, nobody knows whether all of them are rational. I believe they are not. And it's impossible to find a list to put them in any classification you would like. But we can do something better. This is the Fantapier transform of a measure, let's say of compact support in there is a misprint there in C n, and it's one of the basic kernels in complex variables. It's related to the Fourier-Laplace transform, and I wanted to mention this because it is related to what we did before, and of course this is the kernel which appears in the Drury-Jagvertson space, and I think was a leitmotif of the whole week. Why this is so important? Because we can characterize via this transform every linear functional on the space of analytic functions on a convex domain in CN. And the characterization is constructive, and it goes as follows. This was discovered by Martineau and Eisenberg about 40 years ago, and is still a continuous field of research. It's not finished because there are subtle points how to do this in the projective space and so on. So let's try to understand briefly how this duality works. So I have a convex domain in CN. I take this, its polar with respect to the Hermitian inner product. So all points which don't add up to one when evaluated on every point on this domain. And the conclusion is that the Fréchet space of analytic functions on omega is isomorphic to the dual of the dual Fréchet space of analytic functions on germs of analytic functions on the closure of this this polar. It goes either way. And the good news, the proof I want to discuss uses a lot of operator theory. So let's fix a convex domain which contains the ball with its closure in the polar. So maybe I'll so we have the ball, we have a domain, relatively compact there, and this is relatively compact in the polar. And if we look at the Fantapie transform on the Bergman space of an exhaustion of this domain with convex domains, this has a range. Obviously, this is a space of analytic functions, and let's denote artificially this range by script H, and put a norm on it, which makes the transform isometric. In this way, we exhaust the polar with this polar of the domains and the closure with them. And the interesting part is that there is a non-degenerate pairing, that's the whole point, between the Bergman space and this range of the Fantapie transform, given precisely by the, you see here we take the inverse of the Fantapie transform in the Bergman matrix. Little technicality, but this pairing is non-degenerate, obviously, and we remark that the germs of analytic functions on the closure are an inductive limit of this space. The analytic functions on the polar are projective limits on the of the increasing sequence. Well, if we work out the details, this gives us precisely the Heisenberg-Martineau duality. What it is remarkable here, and here I wanted to arrive. There is a B beta missing there. The pairing, surprise, surprise, or maybe not so much a surprise, is exactly the Drury-Jarverson inner product. Because the kernel in the Fantapie transform is the one we are using as a reproducing kernel. So we use this Sisky linear form to define a pairing between spaces of analytic functions in the ball and their reflections, the duals. And the result I wanted to mention is the following. Let's return to our business. We have the analytic functions with this time non-negative real part. And let's consider a subclass of functions which are the Fantapie transforms of positive measures on the sphere. So this time I copy exactly what is happening in the unit ball, and I say why not to consider any positive measure, this kernel, and its transform will give me a function with positive real part. It's easy to remark that the real part of this on the ball is non-negative. How are they related? Well, if we denote by A dagger the duality with respect to this Sisky linear form, the two classes are self-dual. So the transforms, the Fantapie transforms of positive measures is a subclass of all functions with positive real part. But via this duality, they are dual to each other. This is in an older paper with John McCarthy. And it's not very hard to verify this, just playing with the Fantapie transform. Now, all is well maybe before we go to the realization, let's remark one thing. The class M plus involves all positive measures. So here I don't have restrictions on the support of any other thing. I can take point masses. So which are the extremal elements here? Atomic measures, if I cut with a probability measure. Therefore, in M plus, I have a full characterization of the extremal points. But the nasty part of the business is I have a Hilbert space duality. The sphere is very smooth, and I don't know how to characterize extremal elements of the dual. You would say that, sure, this is a simple Lehmann-Hilbert space duality. Well, it's not that, and unfortunately, nobody knows. And this is a good example, I think, to carry and to when we teach functional analysis, that computation of extremal points is not well behaved with respect to duality. Now, finally, operator theory. We have a few minutes to discuss the realization. So, if you remember, here we take in the class M plus all functions which can be represented with the Fantapier transform. And as you well know, if we take an arbitrary spherical isometry, that means a commutative n-tuple of operators satisfying the equation of the sphere in the non-commutative setting, a beautiful observation of Atavale shows that this is subnormal, therefore there is a measure behind it, and representation on the Hilbert space where they act, and fixing vector C will be given by a measure. Therefore, we get for free a realization of all functions in this smaller class, M plus. And this is related to one single identity, commutativity, of course, plus the spherical isometry condition, and vice versa. So we have a dictionary here. Unfortunately, I remember when I was working with John McCarthy on this, we tried to connect this to the extremal elements of the other class. It doesn't work. But the good news is that again, in this case, the extremal elements for the smaller class are easy to characterize. And the good news is that this work with John McCarthy had one reader, and here he is. We are very proud. We had at least one reader, and Michael Jury solved the problem we raised there, namely whether in between the two classes there exists a self-dual one. And indeed, there is one like this. There is much more to say, but I'll skip with the details. It's very beautiful because when we work with intermediate classes of functions, so on the right we have all analytic functions with non-negative real part, on the left the Fantapier transforms of positive measures, in between we may have a big range of big variety of classes. Among them there are self-dual ones, and for instance for each of them there exist, or for some of them, let's be more specific, there exist sister algebra where generated by the elements in the linear pencil of the operator realization, and here we can work with the state of the sister algebra, and we can obtain, for instance, results like there are extremal elements which are not rational for some of these classes. It's a beautiful piece of work just appeared, and I advise you to read his contribution. Now, references. Without offense to Walter Rudin, this is the best text on function theory on the board. It doesn't contain proofs, but contains a lot of ideas, in particular related to the construction of inner functions. It's not well known, and I would like you to have a look and to compare with a book of Rudin or other texts you may like. And then there is a recent, relatively recent book by Mats Andersson, Mikael Passare, and Sigurdsson on the Fantapie transform. And this is also quite pleasant. And the best contribution in that direction, for instance, related to very concrete problems of tomography, goes back to Henkin and Shanani. Now, before finishing, I have to mention that if we look at the Fantapie transforms of positive measures, the class M plus, there is another open problem which is of interest and seems to be very hard, namely to characterize from the coefficients, the Taylor coefficients, this class, or from the moments, same thing, complex moments. Take a positive measure on the sphere, take the integration only along polynomials which are complex analytic. How can you characterize this? If we don't work on the sphere, but rather on the octant, this was done by Henkin and Shananin, and is a Bechstein type result, is a complete positivity, which is again useless because it involves infinitely many, many relations, but at least theoretically it says something. So at least on the left-hand side, the things are not better than on the right-hand side, but we have this duality and we can bounce from one to the other, sometimes with good benefits. I think I'll stop here.